Okay, my friends at 8 to the Bar, I love the music they play. They're fabulous. They're going to be tonight in Oxford, Connecticut, at a place called the Office. And they're going to be doing mostly Motown. There's a great dance floor there. Drinks, of course, lots of fun. And this is all takes place at 35 Old State Road, number 67 in Oxford, Connecticut. It's happening from 8 to 12. Wow. 203-463-8455. You guys who love music and love to dance, this is a place to be.
I guess so. It sounds fabulous. Okay, that's going to do it for our hot spots today. We're going to be coming up on our next guest right now.
Villa Rivoli, Linley had followed the conversation perfectly well, but he very nearly wished he hadn't been able to do so. To have managed to track Hadia to this place, for who else could it be but Hadia, brought into the Alps, and to find themselves just hours too late. He couldn't imagine how he was going to tell the girl's parents. He also couldn't imagine how he was going to relay the information to Barbara Havers. He walked slowly in the wake of the Carabinieri officer and Lo Bianco. Captain Miranda had been told where Domenica Medici was to be found. A short distance from the villa.
Now you're listening to the voice of Davina Porter, and we're very pleased and honored to have Davina Porter in our studios here at WPKN. Welcome to State of the Arts.
Yes, welcome, Davina.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I always like to be here to hear the sound of my own voice.
Do you like to hear it?
Actually, no. I have never listened to any of my recordings once they passed muster. Because I think then I'm always second-guessing what I should have done and thinking, oh, I should, that's awful. I shouldn't have sounded like that. I should have done it in a different way. But as in acting, you make your choice, you do it, and you cannot go back on it.
Right.
So I rather, in my head it's perfect, so I'd rather not hear it and think, ooh, not quite as perfect as
okay.
I thought.
Well, we wanted to acknowledge the fact that you are in the inaugural group of 20 of the book narrators to be inducted into the Hall of Fame. Congratulations.
Yes.
This must
yes.
be quite an honor.
It was. It came totally unexpectedly out of the blue. And I must admit, when I got the email, which came out, I think, in October from my bosses at Recorded Books, but they said, don't say anything yet because it's not official. And I said to Gus, it was like being given a birthday gift. I had such a thrill, and I thought, you're too old to feel like this. But it really was wonderful. I was touched. I was delighted. And it was like an accolade from my peers of the work that I've done over these many years.
Right.
And I'm up there with some really first-class narrators, and I'm very proud and very honored to be part of that group.
There's nothing like being acknowledged and appreciated.
You're absolutely right. That was a friend of mine said, it's an affirmation of your work.
Because you've been doing this for a few decades.
I wish you hadn't said that.
Well, no, but I'm just saying that you just didn't start this. This is what you've put your heart and soul into.
It was actually in the mid-80s, which seems more than a generation ago, And we started with doing unabridged novels. In fact, not novels. The first one was a history, and it was a history of Culloden, the Battle of Culloden. And then my original company, it was always unabridged classics. And I thoroughly enjoyed recording those because initially it's, oh, Lord, we've all had to do these at school and university and everybody hated them. But when you read a classic aloud, there's so much humor in them. And the descriptions, which when you're reading them, sound like you feel like a wadge of bread pudding that you're never going to get to the good bit of the book. When you actually narrate them and you have to say to yourself, you have to make this sound interesting. You become interested in it, and it actually is quite delightful.
Yes.
Some of the Dickens descriptions.
Yes. I think that's so interesting that you're saying that, because I'm thinking now, if you were a student today and you had to take on a classic book, I wonder if you have the choice to read it or to listen to it, and if more people would be inclined to listen and then get more out of these are classics for a reason.
Yes, and I think, yes, you should always read them, but I must admit, to listen to them, it's a whole, it's joyous. It is not drudgery. You can listen to them. You realize why there have been these interminable descriptions, as you might think, reading them. But mm-hmm. when you listen to it, you think, that's the reason. It's not just setting the scene. It is setting the character and why the character is formed and how they behave in that way. Whereas if you do the abridged, mm-hmm. where a lot of that is cut out.
Oh, sure.
You miss such a lot of the background. They were turgid. I mean, the old guys, I shouldn't say that, the revered authors of yesteryear
right.
used, half a dozen words where today it's probably one little.
Yes, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Oh. Now, let's talk, you do the voices and everything.
Yes.
But mention the thing that you told me just before we went on the air, the letter or the call that you got of they like your narrating.
Yes, I had a very nice fan letter from a lady who said she listens to audiobooks and, quote, everybody can do voices. But she said, you bring the narrative alive. You draw the reader in. She said, as you start reading the narration, I want to listen to more. I want to listen to the story you're about to tell. And I'd never appreciated that, and I was very touched by it.
Wow, what a compliment.
Yeah, it was a compliment.
You know, I think it's a Herculean effort to even contact you and give you, because most people, they even might think it.
Yeah.
But then you take that extra step and you actually contact the narrator. I have to admit that up until a few years ago, I had never listened to a book. I love books, so I've read and read read, but I've never listened to them. And it wasn't until I started to take these regular jaunts to Vermont that I thought I have to fill my time with something. And now I'm a junkie. I am an audio junkie. I would rather listen to a book than now I've gotten a little lazy, to tell you the truth. But it's interesting because I was telling Tom I listened to such and such book, and he said, oh, yes, who's the narrator? And I'm always, I don't know. And he said, oh, you should always know who your narrator is as well as you know the author. So I thought that was interesting. So I'm trying to, I'm going to take that on as I take on my next book.
No, I can understand that because a good narrator shouldn't inflict their personality on the book. You should end your audio version thinking, oh, that was a good read. I really enjoyed that.
But there are some voices that are more pleasing to the ear. Each of us. And
yes.
Your voice is incredibly pleasing. It just listening to the beginning of the audiobook that Richard started, it's just, it's lovely. I mean, not the kind that puts you to sleep when you're driving, but just engaging. I guess that's it. It's engaging. And because I know you as an actress and not a narrator, I can only imagine what you put into the characters that you bring to life.
Yes. Well, to go back to sort of putting you to sleep, I will tell a story. When I first started some time ago, I sent a gift to my, I guess she's my stepmama-in-law. And I felt, well, it's a bit hubristic, but I will send her this book. And I said to Grandma Jean, and she called me back and she said, oh, thank you so much for that book, Davina. I loved it. And I said, well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. She said, yes. I take it upstairs to bed, and within 5 minutes of listening to you, I'm sound asleep. So there's always a humbling thing about whenever you think you're getting very conceited and, oh, I'm good at this, somebody in your family will give you a great leveler. So
yes.
She was the voice of reason.
Just being honest, funny. I'm sure. So that was
she was.
Yeah.
She was.
Yeah.
But as you were saying, with getting into the characters of the book, yes, you do a lot of, not research, you must read the book thoroughly from start to finish, which seems a no-brainer. But I do have a colleague who said, oh, no, you should read it, you should record it as you read a new book. But you can't do that.
Oh, I wouldn't think
so. You cannot do
that
because the authors will send you a little backhander. I was recording Thornbirds years ago. And fortunately, I had read it ahead of time because Ralph de Bricissart, one of the main characters, obviously French, has to be with a name like that.
I guess.
So initially I started thinking to myself, French accent. Except around page 80, he replies in his soft Irish brogue he had had since childhood. So Ralph Bricusard was a soft Irish brogue. Yeah. So that's what you have to do. A good writer, the characters are alive. The characters just spring. You just are the conduit. A not so good book where the characters are cardboardy, you have to think to yourself, okay, these characters have to come alive. I have to make them interesting. I have to think, well, you've not actually kept them true. You've made them behave this way in chapter one, and by chapter eight, they've turned tail and they don't sound believable anymore. That's the thread you have to keep in your head to make them sound believable and make them sound good. And in fact, the skill in recording is not recording the well-written narratives or the good authors, it's the bad authors. And I am not mentioning any of those. But that's the skill in making a rather dull book come alive.
Do the authors have to approve you as a narrator?
Some do. Okay. Some have the choice. And I have auditioned for authors and, to my shame, have not made the grade. And there are a couple of authors that insist on me, which is lovely.
Wow.
And yes, and that is always very nice. When you're given a series, if you're successful with the first book, and everybody's happy, the publisher, the author, my own boss, the recording studio, then you're pretty well certain that you will get the second, third, and fourth book.
Mm-hmm.
And you do hope that they're on a stream, because when I first started recording the Alexander McCall Smith, the Isabel Dalhousie's, he was only going to write four. And he did only write four, but he was so, his fan club loved her so much that he's now written nine.
Uh-huh.
And I want him to keep going on and
absolutely.
On and on.
Absolutely, yes. A series is a good thing, isn't it?
I just want to let our listeners know, we're talking with Davina Porter, that is a special guest in the studio with us at WPKN, and we're talking about her narrating audiobooks, and that she is in the inaugural group of 20 that are being inducted into the Narrator Hall of Fame. And I also just want to let everybody know the excerpt that we used right at the beginning. I've got a frog in my throat. Not good for narrating on any books. But it was Elizabeth George's Just One Evil Act. And it will say right on the cover, as it does this one, read by Davina Porter. And as we discussed, you've done almost 550 of these?
Yes, I think I'm getting closer to 600. It's not an arrogance. I just honestly have lost count. You record the book. It's done and dusted, as you say. And it used to be that the books were published, then you made the recording. Now it's simultaneous.
Oh.
The audio comes out at the same time, which sometimes means you have to rush them a bit.
Sure.
Which is difficult. Mind you, it keeps you on your toes.
Yeah.
And yes, and I don't always list what I've done.
Mm-hmm.
So I do periodically think, oh, like you, this one today. Of course, I'd totally forgotten I had done that one because it was some years ago.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm probably closer to 600 now.
And I noticed on the jacket it says 36 hours and 22 minutes or something
yes,
like that.
That.
How much of a span can you do at a time?
I do about 5 hours at a time.
At a time?
At a time. I mean, there are breaks.
Yes.
Oh,
sure,
break.
Sure.
You have to break for a drink because your voice, as you said, gets a frog or gets scratchy. It's about 2 full hours of studio time to get a solid hour of correct, of narrative.
Okay.
That's what you have to allow.
Right.
The Gabaldon series, they are 900 pages. They are 40 to 45 hours of narrative.
And this is the Outlander series.
These are the Outlander series.
And you've done them all.
A long time. I've done them all.
Okay.
I've done 8. The 9th is was due to come out this year, but I think will be out early next year. She's going to write 10, and then she's going to finish, because the Outlander series has now is now a very successful. It started off quite a sleeper on Starz television.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're into their third. They're going to start series 3 next year. And I haven't actually seen them, and I've done it deliberately. I have a vision of Claire in my head.
Hmm.
I sound like Claire. That's mm-hmm. how I make her. She is my narrative voice for Claire. I have a vision of Jamie in my head, and I have a voice for Jamie and for all the Scots and all the characters. If I see them and I hear them, I will probably want to copy them, and that's not going to be good, very good. Okay. I don't want to be a pale impression of somebody. I've seen the actors. Physically, I know what they look like.
Right.
I don't want to see them, and I'm doing it deliberately because good. I think it will change my concept of Claire. I've narrated Claire since 1990.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, I feel I am Claire.
Yes,
darn it.
I guess.
So I don't want to hear the other actress.
Right.
So I have seen her. She's absolutely right for the part. They all are.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to keep in my voices in my head. And also, Claire next year, hopefully I will be doing her, should sound as Claire did from the initial
right.
book.
Yes, that's what I was thinking. Do you think when she finishes the entire series that you'll take that opportunity then to then listen to how the actors interpreted?
I think I would. Mm-hmm. I could then be very happy to look at the series.
Mm-hmm.
And from the sound of things, it's going to go on.
Yes.
Because, of course, then you get into the lovely based on, mm-hmm. so you can just go with the characters.
Right.
And she really is one of the best storytellers. Gabaldon just can take a theme and develop it. And that's part of her, well, it's part of her genius, but part of the problem is she gets sidetracked and does another book on another character before coming back to the main Outlander series. So, but she said she has characters that are mushrooms. She said she's got her main characters.
Yeah.
And she'll do a little side story within the book.
Mm-hmm.
And then she realizes that's a very interesting character. So she'll bring them back later on.
In the book?
In the book. Or in the next book.
Okay.
Or the next book. And I have to think, oh my, I did that person in book 3. I wonder how they sounded. Because now they're
but
back.
But does anybody else really remember, do you think?
I hope not. Though there are some diehard fans. Yeah. There really are.
Well, you know, I just, in my mind, as I listen to audiobooks, I am amazed at how the narrator can keep the characters so consistent and so, and their voices so different, so that I, without saying such a who so said mm-hmm. this, that I know who said it, and still we're still dealing with one
yes.
One narrating thanks. Voice. How in the world do you do that, Davina?
I think, well, now it's practice. Having an acting background, I can't tell you how useful that has been. Because as soon as you see dialogue on the page, you make it, you think as an actress does, how is this person going to sound? If you're in a series, they're still in your head. Mm-hmm. I do make notes. When I go through the whole book, I
yes.
do make a list of characters. If they're minor characters, that's the ones you can have fun with. And you can say, all right, elderly man, toothless, how is he going to sound? And you write that down so that the elderly man, toothless, who then suddenly becomes a character 20 or 40 pages on, and you think, oh my word, that was Murtaugh. I've got to make him sound, but you mustn't be too over the top because mm-hmm. otherwise he becomes
caricature.
It's a caricature, right. And you as a listener can say, I can't be bothered listening to
right.
this.
Mm-hmm. So, will you read something for us in the studio now?
Sure.
Okay,
sure.
Well, which one do you want to do?
Well, because we were talking about Outlander,
okay.
I would like to do her.
All right.
I'd rather start with that.
Sure.
And it will be an excerpt because I can't do 900
oh,
pages.
Oh, sure.
So... Just start now?
You can just start
right.
right now.
Well, this is right at the beginning, the very first Outlander book, and Claire, who is, she's been married, and her honeymoon has been delayed because she was a nurse in World War II, and she's having a belated honeymoon with her husband, Frank. She and Frank are English. They've gone to Scotland. She is an herbalist. She's seen some plants. So she's left Frank at home while she goes up to the moors where there are standing stones. And she sees the plant she wants to get. So she pulls out several roots of the plants and she puts her hand on one of the standing stones. And as she does it, She feels a thrumming sound in the stones, and there's a wonderful chapter of the stones singing to her, but she goes through the stones, back in time, loses consciousness, and we pick up the story from there. She comes into a group of Highlanders, and she thinks she's on a film set because they're all authentically dressed, wearing the plaids, rather dull because the tartans weren't particularly bright at that time. So she keeps very quiet, but they see her, they capture her, they think she's an English spy. So we pick up to where they've taken her to a cottage. I shrank back into the shadows near the fireplace, hoping to avoid notice. The man called Murta had untied my hands before leading me in here. Perhaps I could slip away while they were busy elsewhere. The men's attention had shifted to a young man crouched on a stool in the corner. He had barely looked up through my appearance and interrogation, but kept his head bent, hand clutching the opposite shoulder, rocking slightly back and forth in pain. One of the men pulled back the young man's plaid, revealing a dirt-smeared linen shirt blotched with blood. A small man with a thick moustache came up behind the lad with a single-bladed knife and, holding the shirt at the collar, slit it across the breast and down the sleeve so that it fell away from the shoulder. I gasped. The shoulder had been wounded. There was a deep, ragged furrow across the top and blood was running freely down the young man's breast. But more shocking was the shoulder joint itself. A dreadful hump rose on that side and the arm hung at an impossible angle. Dougal grunted.
Aha, out of joint, poor bugger.
The young man looked up for the first time. Though drawn with pain and stubbled with red beard, it was a strong, good-humoured face.
Fell with my hand out when the musket ball knocked me off my saddle. I landed with all my weight on the hand and crunch, there it went.
Crunch is right.
His accent, probably educated and obviously a Scot, was probing the shoulder and making the lad grimace.
The wound's no trouble. The ball went right through and it's clean. The blood's running free enough. I don't quite know what to do about the disjointure, though. We'd need a chirurgeon to put it back in place properly. You can't ride with it that way, can you, Jamie lad?
Musket ball? I thought blankly. Chirurgeon? The young man shook his head.
Hurts bad enough sitting still. I couldn't manage a horse.
The moustached man sighed.
No help for it, then. We'll have to try and force the joint back. Murta, you and Rupert hold him. I'll give it a try.
I watched in sympathy as he picked up the young man's arm by the wrist and elbow and began forcing it upward. The angle was quite wrong. It must be causing agonising pain.
All right for another go, lad, the bald man asked. Or maybe Rupert should try.
Rupert, so invited, flexed his hands as though about to toss a cabre and, picking up the young man's wrist, plainly intended to put the joint back by main force. An operation, it was clear, that was likely to snap the arm like a broomstick. Don't you dare do that! All thoughts of obvious escape submerged in professional outrage. I started forward, oblivious to the startled look of the men around me. You'll break his arm if you do it like that. Stand out of the way, please. You have to get the bone of the upper arm at the proper angle before it will slip back into place, I said, grunting as I pulled the wrist up and the elbow in. This is the worst part, I warned him. I cupped the elbow, ready to whip it upward and in. Suddenly, the shoulder gave a soft, crunching pop, and the joint was back in place. The patient looked amazed.
It doesn't hurt any more.
It will. It'll be tender for a few days, but you mustn't extend the joint at all. And for several days, stop at once if it begins to hurt and use warm compresses on it daily. I became aware in the midst of this advice that while the patient was listening respectfully, the other men were eyeing me with looks ranging from wonder to outright suspicion. I'm a nurse, you see. Dougal's eyes, and Rupert's as well, dropped to my bosom and fastened there with a sort of horrified fascination.
Be it as it may, said Dougal, for a wet nurse you'd seem to have some skill at healing. Can you staunch the lad's wound well enough for him to sit a horse?
I can dress the wound, yes, I said with considerable asperity. But what do you mean, wet nurse? And why do you suppose I'd want to help you anyway? I was ignored, as Dougal turned and spoke in a tongue I dimly recognised as Gaelic to a woman who cowered in the corner. Look, I said, as patiently as possible, why don't you just take him into the town? It can't be far, and I'm sure there's a doctor there who could see to him. The woman gawped at me. What town? Dougal handed a coin to her and hustled me out of the cottage, followed more slowly by Jamie. It was a moonless night, but the starlight caught the metal bits of the harness, of the horse's harness, in flashes of quicksilver. I looked up. I'd never seen so many stars. With no nearby city to veil the sky with light, the stars here held undisputed dominion over the night. And then I stopped dead, feeling much colder than the night chill justified. No city lights. What town? The woman inside had asked. Accustomed as I was to blackout and air raids from the war years, the lack of light had not at first disturbed me. But this was peacetime, and the lights of Inverness should have been visible for miles.
Whoa!
Exceptional.
Oh, and how. Thank you so much.
A few muddles there. Yeah, which
well, no,
have been.
Come on.
I didn't hear one muddle, and no. I was going to ask you about muddles because obviously.
Stumbles.
No, I didn't hear one stumble, but obviously, in 5 hours of recording, something happens that. Something comes out of your mouth that you hadn't intended. What do we do about
that? Well,
that's
a good engineer. Mm. A good engineer. Oh.
Because I was, you know, the reason I was asking is I read this book, or listened, excuse me, to this book, and there was, it took place in Eastern Europe, and so there was several words that were German words, and it seemed as if they came to, and the character was supposed to know German, so it was supposed to come right to them. And it seemed as if every time there was a German word, it was as if there was a sound differential. It was almost a different voice that came in and said the word, and then it went on in English. And it was very disturbing to me because it interrupted.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, could they have chosen a narrator who couldn't speak the German words, or... Would you actually go back and put them all in with a German voice?
Well, not really. I mean, when you make a mistake like that, they will take you back. I mean, your engineer will stop you rather than and say, Davina, that was messy. Go back and do it again. But it should be consistent.
Oh,
and
sure.
You should be doing your own. They never... No, unless it's a multiple voice recording. But no, from what you're saying,
right.
The narrator couldn't handle the German and they did put in a different voice.
I think that must be bad. Yes, it was a great book. And of course, now right now I can't remember what it was, but it was a great book. But that stood out as something that was unusual to me.
And very unusual.
I wanted to ask you about that. I also wanted to say that, you know, you are obviously from London and you have this beautiful English accent, but your ability to do the Scottish accent, do you give Gus all of the accolades here? Or?
I think so.
Gus is her husband, so you know.
Mm-hmm. And we've been married 55 years, and when you've listened to a Scottish accent day in and day out, it has to rub off. So, yes.
That's good.
And my mother was a Scot, though she was very English. She was born in Scotland but lived in London and always very English. So, I think it's being married to a Scot for all this time.
Mm-hmm. Is it difficult to read some of what authors have written? I'll think of, we have a friend, Peggy and I have a mutual friend, who listened to you read a book and there were some sexual scenes in it. And he said it was very hard for him to listen to it, knowing you personally and how you must have reacted when you had to read it.
Well, the first sex scene I had, I think, was actually in Outlander. And I was so pleased I had a woman engineer. And I was also a bit awkward about doing it. I thought, oh, is it going to sound stilted? Is it going to sound vulgar? So when I came out, she actually didn't say a word. She handed me a cigarette.
Oh my god!
Perfect.
So it was. Yes.
Oh my god!
I'm uncomfortable reading sex scenes. I really am. But I think to myself, hey, put yourself in the author's head. That's all you do. Yes. You're the conduit. You're not the judge. Read. This is what's there. And if it's a well-written sex scene, and Gabaldon does do well-written sex scenes, you can do it.
Okay. We have about 1 minute left. What's the most recent thing that you have done that we can look for?
The most recent thing is a very good history called Paradise in Chains, and it's the story of the founding of Australia as a penal colony, and also the mutiny on the Bounty. It's a concurrent story. Okay. It's very, very good, and I enjoyed reading. I like all books. I can't say I prefer one above another. Give me a good author, and I'll read it.
Oh, fantastic. Well, give us a good narrator, and we'll have her as a guest anytime on our show. Congratulations on being inducted into the Narrator Hall of Fame, and it's been such a pleasure to have you here. Both Peggy and I take a great deal of pride in the fact that we know you, and we've listened to you, and we've seen you on stage, and